Imagine that you were living in a time where there had been a long reign of a narcissistic dictator. A long reign. That is where multiple generations lived with oppression, tyranny, and fear. For many years, the people around you had all been terrorized. You had been terrorized. People had even been killed by those in power. Imagine for many years not being able to gather or practice the religion and customs of your birth. All those things that meant the most to you were outlawed. And then imagine, hope against hope, that a small group of rebels, without any resources or enough people, without any real reason to think that they could be successful, that they managed to overthrow those in power and liberate everyone into a new and possible freedom. This is the story of Hanukkah. The story of the Jewish people after the rebellion of that small band that we know of as the Maccabees. Finally, they who had lived on the edge of despair for so long were able to return to their temple, which for them was that thing we talk about at the beginning of the welcome, a place of sanctuary, of memory and hope. They were celebrating there in their temple. They were returning. They were remembering and reclaiming and purifying. The Assyrian army had finally been defeated. They were free. In the historical record, this is the miracle of Hanukkah. Just this. And it is enough that a small community of people refused to cooperate with their oppression. They kept at it generation to generation. They refused to accept the world as it was and continued to act until liberation finally became a reality. That's the historical record. The rabbinical record, however, keeps going past this part of the story. And it reminds us that for many years before this uprising, when the Jews had been hiding in caves and fending off arrest, they had missed their great festival of Sukkot, which must be celebrated in that temple that they were not allowed to go to. And so now that they had returned, they could begin the ritual as their promises with their God required. As they began, however, they realized that the Assyrians had destroyed all but one night's worth of the oil for the lamp that they needed for their ritual. They needed 8 days' worth of oil. Anything less would not allow for a true rededication or a commitment to begin again as a religious community and as a people. After all they had been through, it mattered that they do it right. It mattered that they not let that light go out. And so, as the story goes, rather than the lamp staying lit for that one day, the oil actually ended up lasting the whole 8 days. These 8 days are why Hanukkah is celebrated for 8 nights. Each night, you light a new candle on the menorah. Now, in the rabbinical telling, this, of course, was the miracle, that the oil lasted for the whole 8 days, far beyond what it should have. This is how you end up on Hanukkah having latkes and other oil-infused foods. Reminder of how much oil there ended up being. But both of these moments, the uprising of the Maccabees and their success, and then the oil lasting, these are miraculous, amazing, and inspiring, of course. And yet they aren't what has always struck me as the most miraculous truth at the heart of the story of Hanukkah. For me, the miracle in Hanukkah is something much less showy, more routine. The miracle for me is the choice that the Jewish people made to light the candle in the first place. Because they didn't think it would last, right? What made them make the choice to light the candle in the first place? It was that choice that made the 8 nights of light ultimately possible. They made the choice to light the lamp even though it was hopeless. They made the choice even though they probably didn't think it would make a real difference. But something in them persuaded them to expect that something else might be at work. Something beyond their own effort or their own vision. In making that choice, they chose to believe, as writer Arundhati Roy writes, "Another world is not only possible, she is on her way." Her writing goes on, she says, "On a quiet day, I can hear her breathing." This choice, to me, is the miracle. Expecting the miracle was the miracle. Because by their expectations, they made the miracle possible. Since researcher Robert Rosenthal began studying expectations and their impact in the 1950s, it has been repeatedly shown that what we expect shapes not only our own experiences, but also others' experiences. And in small yet meaningful ways that accumulate, our expectations can impact, as in they can change reality. One study, for example, describes how golfers were told they had a lucky ball, and they made more putts than when they used an ordinary ball. Expectations. Another, highly trained weightlifters are shown to outdo their personal bests of how much they can lift when they're told they've taken a performance booster. Expectations. And repeatedly, studies have shown that a teacher's expectations can raise or lower a student's IQ score. Not just their grades, for one time, but their IQ score. This was actually one of the earliest discoveries from Rosenthal in the 1950s, how a teacher's unconscious bias, their expectations, and specifically he looked at their potential racial bias, how it impacts how well a child learns. For example, he figured out that when a teacher expects more from a child, they will wait longer for the child to respond after they've asked them a question. Or they will also take longer to explain a subject when a child seems like they're struggling to understand. They'll take a longer time to make sure that they actually understand because they expect that they will eventually understand. These are barely noticeable, usually subconscious shifts resulting from our expectations, and yet they have a huge collective impact on our reality. This is what we might call the placebo effect. I mean, this long disparaged idea where we can be fooled by fake medicine that trick us somehow into believing that we are being healed. But here, this placebo effect is just being played out socially, collectively. What's interesting, though, is that we are learning that far from being fake, the placebo effect is actually a manifestation of a very real, very complex scientific truth. It's just that rather than the medicine, or more generally the change, coming from a pill or some other external factor, it comes from within us, that is, from within our brains. This is the basic premise of science writer Eric Vance's fascinating 2016 book. If any of you have read it, it's called Suggestible You. Subtitle, The Curious Science of Your Brain's Ability to Deceive, Transform, and Heal. Our brains, Vance describes, are wired for the future. That is, they are constantly assessing what's going to happen next. Almost all that's happening subconsciously. So this is actually connected to the time warp that Sean spoke about last week, because the way that our brains predict the future is by drawing on the past, what they know from their past experience. So all the time, our brains are taking our past experiences, and by the past, that might mean like 2 seconds ago, or 2 years ago, or 20 years ago, whatever it is, it's taking our past experiences and then using it to predict the future. And again, like 2 seconds from now, or 2 years from now, or 20 years from now, I read one article about, just think that even taking a walk is based on your expectations. Just thinking that there's your brain is anticipating something that might happen next, right? Like if I keep walking, my brain's already acknowledging and anticipating and adjusting then in turn how I act in the present. So this is the brain's always predicting what's going to happen in the future based on the past in order to make decisions in the present. And then, as I feel like I've been saying in every sermon lately, our brains don't like to be wrong, right? Our brains like to be right. And so they want the expectations that they're making, our brains are making about the future. Our brains want those things to be right. They don't want those future expectations to be wrong. So sometimes, amazingly, instead of shifting our expectations, our brains shift reality. Let me offer an example. I'm going to go back to golf. So if we know from the past about some experience that felt like we were playing with a lucky ball, because we played better with that ball than we ever played before, then when we play with a ball that we're told is lucky, our brains expect the outcome to be the same as in that prior experience. And so often our body and mind will automatically make small unconscious choices that can ultimately all add up to playing a better game. We become more focused, less anxious, more confident, clear. All because our brains want the expected future to line up with the actual future. Again, subconscious decisions. You may have no idea this is happening. And what's wild is it actually doesn't even matter if you know that it's probably not an actually lucky ball. Just acting as if it's lucky. Like all the theater you have around having a lucky ball, the performance of it for yourself, it hooks your subconscious to engage the things that would produce the original expectation. One of my favorite stories from Vance's reporting is the story of an experimental Parkinson's treatment, a treatment for Parkinson's disease. It wasn't a pill in this case, it was a surgery. Participants in the study would come in for the surgery, brain surgery, and then some would get the surgery and some wouldn't. Now, in order to make sure that nobody knew, they went so far as to like drilling little kind of superficial holes in the skull. So everybody as if left thinking they had the surgery. Well, one patient, after he had his surgery, it changed his life. I mean, he had Parkinson's, and before that he'd been having trouble walking. He was struggling to talk. After his surgery, he started heli-skiing, right? Dropping from a helicopter, skiing, right? He climbed the backside of the Half Dome in Yellowstone. Everyone was thrilled from these results. They thought they had cured Parkinson's. But then 2 years later, when it was time to unblind the study, guess what? He didn't have the surgery. And again, it's important to say this. It wasn't that it was fake, right? The experience itself activated real physiological differences in the brain and in his body that literally created this patient's expected future. Now, of course, expectations do not entirely determine reality. We wish. As Chris Burdick describes in his book, Mind Over Mind, there are certainly limits to what the placebo effect can do. When my son broke his arm last month, for example, we couldn't just sort of expect it would get better. He had to get treatment. Or expectations can't fix poverty, racism, the climate crisis. Again, we wish. Vance describes it like this: placebos can't stop the disease, but they can often limit or even erase the impact of the disease. Expectations shift things in small, often imperceptible ways, so that as our expectations shift, small, imperceptible things in us shift, in our bodies, in our actions. And from these shifts, small, imperceptible things shift in others and in the world around us. And all of these effects, these small things, can all accumulate and add up to make a very big difference. There's another story in the Talmud, a story of the Jewish people hundreds of years before the story of Hanukkah. At that time, they had been slaves in Egypt for 400 years, until a man named Moses led them to their freedom. This story is the moment when Moses was trying to do just that. They had left Egypt, and Moses was leading them out of Egypt into the promised land, until he found himself at the edge of the Red Sea. His people were all around him, hungry for liberation, and all Moses and his people had to do was go forward. Freedom was waiting for them, except there was this sea, big and deep. Moses looked to God, unsure what to do, but nothing happened. The ocean in front of him remained wild, unfriendly. It seemed hopeless. Until from the back of the crowd, a man named Nachshon pushed his way forward and started walking into the sea. Nachshon, he was just a regular guy. He'd never heard a voice from a burning bush or anything. But in that moment, he just decided that what he could do was keep walking. Moses stared at him. Others started to point and yell at him, "What are you doing? You'll drown." But Nachshon, he just kept walking. He waded through the rising tide. The water hit his calves. He kept walking. Water hit his waist. He kept walking. The water came up to his chest and then his shoulders. He kept walking. The water was all around him until finally it was at his nostrils, about to fill his lungs, and it was in that moment the Red Sea parted. And the Israelites could continue their journey to freedom, moving safely through the walls of water, safely through the sea. His expectation of the miracle made the miracle possible. In this story of Hanukkah, when the Jewish people decided to expect something other than what all reason might have told them was possible, this is a story they would have remembered. This is the memory, their collective memory, that their brains would have used to shape a story about their collective future. "I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt," their scriptures say again and again. So that when the question of whether or not they should step out to resist that oppressive regime again and again, or whether they should light the lamp even though there was not enough oil, though the present reality said it was hopeless, their brains were sure something else was possible. Freedom. Liberation. They expected a miracle and made the miracle possible. Over the past few years, there have been many moments where I know many of us have wondered if there's anything that any of us could do that would make a real difference. So many places today make the Hanukkah story feel not all that distant in our world or in our personal lives, which is why the Hanukkah story should feel to us like such good news for us in our lives today. Because what Hanukkah reminds us is that we can unlock the power of our expectations. We can draw on our past in all the ways we have changed and healed and repeatedly walked into the sea and it parted. We can draw on a collective courage, which is one of the core values here at Foothills. For as many times as I have seen people struggle to know how and when to act, just as often I've been bolstered by someone stepping out, like Nachshon, making the way by just walking forward. This is a collective courage, a collective memory that can in turn fuel a collective expectation. We don't know what the future will bring in our own lives or in the world. We don't know if our actions will be enough, but the only way that they could be is if we act as if they are. If we take the step forward to light that first candle, if we act in expectation of the miracle and make the miracle possible. May it be so, and amen.